10 minutes past 5 o'clock, and we're returning to the report on the Miami Showband murders in 1975. Today's report by the Historical Inquiries team gives support to what many have been claiming for years, that there was evidence of police collusion and cover-up surrounding the case. Three members of the band were shot dead in what was one of the most memorably shocking episodes of the Troubles. They were Fran O'Toole, Tony Geraghty and Brian McCoy. They were attacked by a loyalist terrorist gang which included members of a regiment of the British Army, the UDR. I'm joined by Paul O'Connor of the Pat Finucane Centre. Paul O'Connor, good evening.
Good evening, Mary.
The report is the property of the families and of the victims. It wasn't released in full. They have released recommendations and commentary by various family members. Why is it that the full report isn't put into the public domain?
Well, essentially, I think listeners need to realise that a HET report is basically a police investigative report into a murder, and is provided to the family. So it also contains considerable personal details, questions asked by the family, follow-up, and the responses to that. So it's not intended. The HET themselves don't release reports publicly. They give them to families, and where families choose to, they put the conclusions and the findings of that report into the public domain.
Now, to explore maybe further with you this crucial finding in relation to the RUC and possible collusion, the inquiry team's verdict that has been quoted to us, and I'll read it here. To the objective, impartial observer, disturbing questions about collusive and corruptive behaviour are raised. The Historical Inquiries Team review has found no means to assuage and rebut these concerns, and that is a deeply troubling matter. Now, can you take us underneath that and perhaps back into what they are talking about here?
Yeah, Mary, I mean, essentially, they have devoted 11 pages of this report, of a 90-page report. They've devoted 11 pages to this troubling issue around the involvement of Robin Jackson. Clearly, they haven't done that if they didn't think that there was considerable evidence linking him to the attack. There is a number of issues that arise out of that, maybe just to clear that up. His fingerprints are found on a weapon sometime after the Miami murders. He has been arrested in the immediate aftermath of it and released. And then at a later date, a weapon is found with his fingerprints, and he tells the interviewing officers that he has already been warned about this by other officers, by senior officers, and told to get offside. They are concerned by that, report that back to headquarters, and the HET can find no evidence that anything was ever done about that, that essentially allegations of a criminal nature simply aren't followed up, and that has alarmed them greatly. As I said, they devoted 11 pages to it. Now, of course, it gives rise to the question, was Robin Jackson at the scene? And there is considerable accompanying evidence that he actually was. To give you one example, on the 8th of August, just days after the Miami attack, the Secretary of State reports to the Prime Minister and tells the Prime Minister at that time that a number of people are in custody who are responsible for the Miami Showband attack. And on the 8th of August, Robin Jackson is in custody. It's also quite clear he was a leader of the UVF in the Lurgan-Portadown area at the time. This attack was carried out by at least 10 or 12 members of the Lurgan-Portadown UVF. There's also classified intelligence available to the HET, which has told them which has put Jackson at the scene. This is classified. It wasn't even released within the report what the source of that is. But it's quite clear that they came to the conclusion when they devoted 11 pages to this that he was actually involved.
What more do we know about his relationship with the RUC?
Well, I think this is the first time that such very clear and damning evidence has emerged of a very a strange relationship that he had, given that he was a very prolific loyalist killer. I mean, he first came to attention when he was charged with the murder of a man called Patrick Campbell in Banbridge, and he was identified by Patrick Campbell's widow as the man that came to her door and shot her husband dead. She was the one that answered the door. Under very, very mysterious circumstances, those charges were dropped. He was then involved in an arms raid on a UDR base, of which he was a UDR member, in which a large number of weapons were stolen. And shortly after that, he left the UDR. He was found in a field just weeks before the Miami murders with other loyalist paramilitaries with weapons. And again, the HET have not been able to find what happened in the immediate aftermath of of that incident. And so we have this catalogue of cases where Robin Jackson seems to mysteriously avoid crime and punishment. In fact, in relation to this particular incident where his fingerprints were found, the judge found at trial that he was convinced that Jackson's fingerprints had been found on the silencer of the Luger, but the judge extraordinarily said that he hadn't been convinced that there was necessarily a malicious explanation for that, and he walked from the court.
Now, Paul, Jackson's dead, but yeah. As my colleague Philip Boucher-Hayes pointed out in an earlier report he did for us on the programme, there were only 12 detective superintendents in the RUC at that time. Is it possible to still go back into those records and go back to the RUC and start doing interviews and trying to extract more information about what may or may not have been going on at that time?
Yes, well, of course, this refers to the fact that the HET have now referred this report to the Chief Constable and to the Police Ombudsman because they're so concerned about the allegations. So the Police Ombudsman, when their office gets reconstituted in terms of their historic inquiries, will be looking at this issue. It may not be possible to find out who this detective superintendent was. I'm not sure if that's particularly the issue. I think the families have said, and I've heard them saying it today, the issue for them is what happened when this information reached headquarters? What was done? What wasn't done? Why wasn't it done? Why wasn't it followed up? Why didn't this emerge in court? And I think there's troubling questions there for the prosecution service in the north, because this was Jackson's explanation for why his fingerprints had been found, that they were on the tape rather than the silencer, which wasn't true. So what did happen to all of that? I think there's general questions that deserve to be asked, to be looked at. I don't think the issue here is about identifying one or other people who might have been involved in this and they're being held to account. I don't think they probably will be held to account at this point, but the organisation should be held to account. One last thing, Mary, maybe to point out.
Yeah.
In the immediate aftermath of the Miami Chauvin murders, the British government and the Secretary of State vociferously denied the Irish government concerns that there may have been collusion. In fact, they were very annoyed at Gareth Fitzgerald's comments and the comments of others in government at the time. Within weeks of the Miami murders, there was a meeting between the Secretary of State, the Prime Minister, who was Harold Wilson, and the leader of the opposition, who at that time was Margaret Thatcher. We have the minutes of that meeting. And in that meeting, Margaret Thatcher, as leader of the opposition, is told by the Prime Minister, the army believe that the UDR is heavily infiltrated by loyalist paramilitaries. So they knew what was actually happening.
Are there other issues and questions answered in this report today that will bring some closure to family?
I think that from the family's reaction and families, you know, have been digesting the report over the past couple of weeks, I think they believe that their concerns have finally been taken seriously, that an investigative piece of work has been done. There's questions they would like to have answered that maybe will never be with the passage of time. But I think they're anxiously awakened what might happen now in terms of the actions of the Police Ombudsman, and I think they'd like a meeting with the Prosecution Service in the North to have some of these other questions addressed.
So you think that's where the quest for justice for the relatives goes from here?
Yes, I think there's questions here. If, you know, if the allegation is that someone who most people in the North believe to have been a state agent, if there's an allegation that he was present at the scene of the Miami ambush. Mm-hmm. Was he debriefed afterwards? Who debriefed him? Who did he tell within Army Intelligence? Who did he tell within RUC Special Branch? Who knew what had actually happened at that point in time, and why was nothing done about it?
Three men were convicted of the three murders, but on the basis of evidence that has been heard, and as you've been outlining there was perhaps 10 gang members present on the night. They've never been identified. They've never been brought to justice. Many of them still alive, perhaps, and still out there.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if we really know if they've never been identified. I mean, I suspect that Robin Jackson has told his handlers exactly who was involved in the Miami ambush at that stage. The HET are very clear and very careful not to throw names about, and that's why this section on Jackson is actually quite extraordinary in a HCT report. But I believe that the names of the people who were involved are known, but that there's a difference between the names being involved, of those involved being known, and that to reach the kind of evidential standard that would ever lead to a prosecution. I think the families made clear today that they are not expecting that any further prosecutions would follow from this.
Paul O'Connor, thank you very much for joining us. That's Paul O'Connor of the Pat Finucane Centre. And after the break, we'll talk to surviving band member Stephen Travers.